Hello and welcome and happy new year. This is the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader, and today we're going to take a bit of a different tack on the podcast. With me is Carolina Milanesi, a tech analyst with Creative Strategies. Hello and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So today we're going to talk about a couple of really, I think, important topics that are relevant to anybody following tech in 2019. And, you know, you have a very, I think, unique vantage point as an analyst. You're somebody who does not look at one particular ecosystem or category. You just want to sort of survey the entire landscape and see how the big players are doing on their own and affecting one another. So earlier this week, right after New Year, in fact, the Tim Cook released a letter on, it was, I think, late at night even, and it kind of took everybody by surprise. And in the letter, he pointed to a updated revised guidance for Apple's fiscal Q1 2019 earnings, where he said that there will be a shortfall in revenue by about $8 billion, which is not an insignificant number. And a lot of it pointed to their issues with iPhone sales in China in particular, and he emphasized issues with emerging markets. Carolina, do you want to just walk us through a little bit of what the letter states and how you see it from a more top-level perspective?
Yeah, there were a few things that were mentioned in the letter, but as you point out, Greater China was the bulk of the reason behind the slowdown in sales on iPhone. And what Cook highlighted both in the letter and in a couple of interviews that he did that day was the fact that it wasn't so much the idea of the Apple boycott or the idea that the sanctions are impacting the cost and therefore the price, but more that the sanctions are impacting on an economy that is already weak. And therefore, reading between the lines, it seems that they're impacting consumer confidence. And so he was specifically singling out, you know, less traffic in their store, their partner stores, specifically in the month of November. And he said they still don't have December data. And that was backed up as well by some of my analyst colleagues from IDC, Counterpoint, and other agencies that track the market in China and looking at really sales and what, you know, sell in and sell through. So push and pull on the demand side. I think what is interesting, though, is that it's not just China. And so obviously fair, you know, economic environment, there's not a lot that you can do as a company to you have to ride through it. But there were other issues internationally where Cook specifically mentioned the fact that installed payments are becoming the de facto way that consumers buy their phones. And so contracts and subsidies have gone away. And we've had that throughout the last couple of years. The other part was because of that, the upgrade cycles are lengthening. It's been interesting that, for instance, here in the US, some carriers have moved from a 24 months to a 36 month installed payment contract when you're buying the 10S Max, for instance, because of a higher price. So, you know, that cycle is lengthening because of the higher cost of the devices. And then lastly, the idea that some consumers have actually jumped on board of the battery replacement offer for $29 instead of upgrading their phone. So people that have, you know, a 6S, instead of looking at upgrading, just changing the battery and finding that, you know, performance goes back to normal, that they have what they need from a feature set perspective, and therefore they're happy campers. So there's a lot in there that I think is worth talking about, but it seems that most of the commentary gets to the prices of the iPhones are too high and Apple is being priced out by, especially in China, competitors like Huawei and Xiaomi and Oppo and OnePlus, which absolutely have grown over the past 2 years for merit of their own, not just because they have cheaper phones, but because their phones have got materially better than they used to. And so for consumers looking at, I want the best phone that I can afford, they are now a good alternative.
Yeah, so this being the Android Central podcast, I want to put a light on the broader market in relation to Apple, because everything in the smartphone ecosystem tangentially is affected by what Apple does, whether it's by design, whether it's by pricing, you know, their acquisitions. I mean, we've seen, we saw even as far back as 2011 when Apple acquired the component maker of the first fingerprint sensor that would eventually become Touch ID in the iPhone 5S. Right. 2 years later, that technology was no longer available to OEMs like Motorola, which, you know, had a very large impact. Apple's purchase of the maker of Siri, which, you know, also was creating products for a broader smartphone market. These are important things to keep in mind in 2019, because Apple in China in particular does not have an enormous market share. It's 9% it was 9% in Q3 2018, according to Counterpoint. That is down from its highs in at the end of 2017, 15%. You know, I remember in 2014 when Apple launched the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, that was the inflection when larger phones became standard.
Right.
And the Chinese market became an enormous growth market for Apple. And a lot of its competitors, Xiaomi, Vivo, Oppo, they were just coming into their own at the time. Mm-hmm. And Huawei was still producing phones, but they weren't great. So we had sort of the Samsung-Apple duopoly in many parts of the world, local brands in China and India. And in North America, things were playing out largely as they are today, with Apple and Samsung, you know, taking the bulk of the market share in the high end. But talk about the changes in that Chinese marketplace over the last 3 or 4 years, because it's so significant. You said, you know, Xiaomi, Oppo, Vivo, Huawei, those four companies make up, you know, 75, almost 80% of the market in China.
Yeah.
And yet Apple still has a disproportionate amount of the mind share. Why is that? And you know, with this announcement of a revenue shortfall largely falling on the greater China area, is that going to change?
I think there's the idea that everything is measured against Apple is not going to go away, right? And some is self-inflicted. I was joking about this at the Huawei launch of the P20 Pro, because, you know, that they have so much goodness of their own, but yet the temptation of always comparing themselves to Apple is there. And so half the presentation, you have references to Apple and how they do it. And I think that that is a syndrome that people have, to, you know, kind of compare themselves to what the benchmark of the high end and that brand that you aspire to be is going to be. So that's from a talking point perspective. What I find extremely interesting about the Chinese vendors is that over the years, a lot of them, and I point particularly at OnePlus, just because lately I've seen great things coming from them, they found their own way, right? They found their own path and they walk their own path. And they don't necessarily always kind of look and respond to what Apple or Samsung, for that matter, do, which I think is great news, because being in control of your own path and deciding who you want to be as a vendor is very important. Huawei is still trying to find that. You know, I think that they seem to go ahead a little bit and then they fall back in their kind of earlier behavior of just trying to mimic what others do. But one big thing that changed in the market, you were asking about, you know, the past 3 years and how the dynamic has changed, is that made in China wasn't cool in China. And you know, the Chinese brands were seen as a lower end. I started tracking the market longer than I want to admit. And in 2011 was the start of what was the white box market in China. So you had, you know, between 10 and 15 million of phones that were sold that were non-brands. And a lot of the companies, I was at Gartner at the time, and a lot of, you know, other competitors were not necessarily tracking all of that because the market was getting bigger and the market share of the leading companies was shrinking, which didn't make them really happy. But that phenomenon turned into what the market is today. And those brands went from, I need a phone and I can't afford anything else, so I'm going to buy made in China, to now actually having Chinese consumers being proud of buying Xiaomi. And I think Xiaomi is probably, with OnePlus, the best example of that, you know, cult almost mentality that they were able to create, where people are really proud of carrying made in China. And that is, for me, the biggest change in what Apple is facing today, is not just that the phones got better, the quality got better, the design, it's much more in line with what the international markets want, not just the Chinese market. But the idea of made in China is cool has changed the dynamic of their competition.
And is that true of outside China as well? You know, Apple does not have as great an impact in, say, Europe as it does in North America. The market share in most Western European countries is similar to China. It's around 9-10%, with Android making up, you know, enormous numbers, 85-90%. In Germany, I believe it's over 90%, similar to in Spain. You know, those, I know that Xiaomi just launched the Mi 8 Pro in the UK. Yeah. To great fanfare. OnePlus launched on a carrier in the United States with additional support for Verizon. I mean, how significant are these launches in the long run for Apple's chances or Apple's growth abilities in the smartphone game? Or have, you know, I hate to keep using the word the term inflection point, but have we reached an inflection point where iPhone is no longer going to be a reliable source of growth for the company, and they're going to have to shift over to services revenue and getting their growth from wearables, AirPods, and other categories like iPad and Mac?
Yeah, so there's a few things there. Getting growth from other products and services, absolutely. And that needs to happen, you know, even if, you know, they can keep sales flat, right? Because you need to look at other opportunities going forward. And you have an install base that is so large now that, you know, Apple has to be able to capitalize from that, because they're in a unique position to do so from a services perspective. Now, as far as the market in Europe, the market there has always been very diverse. And I used to be based in the UK up until 2012. And it was fascinating going back. I had not been for a while, and I went back for the Huawei launch, as I mentioned earlier. And just looking at people around in the street, it reminded me of that variety that you see people carrying different brands. And it used to be, back in the day, Nokia and Alcatel and Siemens and, you know, all European brands. And all of those disappeared. In Nokia's back, but it's not really Nokia, is the name and another company, right? But the idea is that all those vendors that have been replaced now by Chinese names. And so, you know, Huawei has always been popular in southern Europe. And then UK is the closest market in Europe to the US from a high-end proportion of the market is very Apple and Samsung focused. But the rest of the market where prepay, you know, so non-contract users is still very prominent, have been always a bit more price sensitive. And that's where, you know, the Chinese brands came in. You know, interesting, Samsung and LG first came into Italy as a market and then moved, you know, somewhere else and then expanded to Europe. So, you know, that, if you like, that dynamic has always been there in Europe. Now, to your question specifically, does that mean that the opportunity for Apple is shrinking? Churn is not something that you see as dramatically as you did at the beginning, especially in the high end. People have bought into an ecosystem, and so you don't see people going back and forth between Android and Apple. I think the concern, it was interesting chatting yesterday to some people on Twitter who are based in Europe, is that, you know, with Apple, you have the idea of with the hardware, I get software and services and apps. But when you're talking about services, the world is not equal to the US, right? And this is the problem that Amazon has, Google has. But the core that comes with Android, so, you know, Maps and the Google services, is everywhere but China. So, you know, it's more like for like, whereas some of the things that we have here from Apple, like, for instance, news, are not present in other markets. So, you know, I was reminded by my mom because I was like, why don't you look, you know, why are you using Flipboard still and you're not using Apple News? And she's like, we don't have it in Italy. And I'm like, what? So, you know, the idea that I pay the same price for an iPhone in France or Italy or wherever that I pay in the US, actually more because of the weakness of the dollars, but I don't have a return from an ecosystem perspective that I have in the US, start to be something that people are noticing. And so, you know, will that mean that people are switching to Android? That is something that might happen. But like I said, if you are in the high end and you're buying the latest products, it's more going to be price or features that is going to get you to switch. Because, you know, with that switch comes a switch in the operating system and therefore the ecosystem, and you are somewhat already, you know, you're invested in what you've been using for years. What I'm more concerned about with this scenario that we are painting is actually Samsung, because that's where, you know, we've seen leadership in the Android market for so long now, because they've done very well with their products. But now you have alternatives within Android. And so, you know, what can they do to fence off? Because that change is easier, right? You're still in the Android ecosystem, but now you have an alternative. Are you going to go to Huawei, or are you going to go to OnePlus, or now even Xiaomi in Europe? So I think that's where my concern is higher.
So that actually brings up a really good point. You know, you and many other analysts, my colleague Rene Ritchie, he and they've all brought up this notion that in China the actual platform isn't as important because everything runs on WeChat. And that to switch platforms, to go from iOS to Android or vice versa, does not introduce the same amount of friction, because all you do is when you log into your new phone, you don't log into Google necessarily. There is no Google in China. You open WeChat and you go from there. Within the Android ecosystem, you know, you've talked about and you wrote a really interesting piece in TechPinions yesterday, as I'm recording this, called Digging a Little Deeper into Apple Revenue Warning. And right at the bottom, you talk about Apple versus other smartphone vendors and how, you know, there's no other company in the Android world that does what Apple does through ecosystem lock-in, except maybe Xiaomi. But Xiaomi has, you say, the only exception being Xiaomi, but with the caveat that its monetization helps recuperate the initial loss on hardware. So we're talking about a company that sells its phones at a very low margin, if at all. They've claimed that they don't aim for anything higher than a 5% margin on their hardware, and they do so that they can show you ads and get you locked into their services. But companies like Samsung, Huawei, they don't have, and they haven't been able to do the same thing. They don't have that ecosystem. So is there friction for people in moving between vendors within Android? And do you find that people are, say, loyal to Huawei, loyal to Samsung, and to a lesser extent, loyal to companies like Oppo, Vivo, and Xiaomi, or do people, when they upgrade, they just look around and find the best deal?
In Europe, it's always been, I pick the phone I want, and I'm going to go and get the best deal, which always struck me when I came here, which was the opposite. It was, I get the best, you know, data plan or whatever, and then I get whatever phone comes with it. So it's always been fascinating how the focus in European market has always been about the phone first. And I think China, it's similar. Like you said, in China, it's much easier. There's no friction because your phone is basically evolves around WeChat. So it doesn't matter what you're using, right? At the end of the day, it's a piece of glass. And so what matters to you are the features. And Chinese consumers are very tech savvy. And so, you know, RAM and what's inside the phone is valued much more than not the design, for instance. But in Europe, there's not a lot of friction. The worst is actually the UI. And so vendors that keep a cleaner UI, and we've seen this over the years, you've seen Motorola do it, you've seen HTC do it. No, it helped HTC, but they did it nonetheless. And now OnePlus, they try and stay very close to the Android pure experience. And I think that helps because it's cleaner for the user, but obviously lower the stickiness, if you like, of your own brand. I think what the issue is that the four brands who are trying, and I point specifically at Huawei, a lot of times the experience is actually not very nice, and that is doesn't create stickiness; it just creates frustration. And you know,
are you talking specifically about the what they consider to be like their unique features, their lock-in?
No, I'm talking really at the skin that they put on top. Oh, okay. So the actual user interface, yeah. So there's a lot there that because these companies, you know, are not software company, they are hardware company, that becomes more a frustration than anything else. Xiaomi, I think, is one of the ones that has done it best with the skin, because with the skin comes the layer of services that they have. And so it has a more of a purpose than not trying to give me a UI that is different from pure Android just for the sake of it. So I think that's where more, you know, you have people looking at different phones and then realizing that they don't look and feel all the same way. And so there's a little bit of frustration there. But from an ecosystem perspective, to your point, I can switch and go from a Samsung to a Huawei to a Xiaomi or a OnePlus without much difficulty.
That's, I'm finding, more and more true. You know, I've been in this game for a decade now. Switching between Android phones was fine because, you know, the first thing you did was you logged in with your Google account, and some right. of your settings, some of your apps, some of your data was restored. Today, that experience is considerably more robust. You get most of what you want going from one phone to another. And to their credit, the OEMs have included many additional tools that allow you to pull even more data, like text messages from your previous phone. You know, Samsung in particular, with its smart switch, has a very robust tool. Google itself now has a really good one. You know, it, and it's it's as seamless as you're going to get. It's not quite iPhone. I just switched my wife's iPhone 7 over to an iPhone 10 this week, and the experience is basically magic. It's something that Apple OEM or Android OEMs haven't quite matched, with, you know, you pointing your camera at this glowing orb and it syncs up everything. And then the restore is seamless. You get basically everything from your iCloud account onto your iPhone. My wife basically had a brand new phone in half an hour. That isn't quite
that
there yet.
That felt like her old phone, right? It, so it, that's the beauty.
Exactly. Identical. I mean, you get most of that with going from a Pixel 2 to a Pixel 3 or a Samsung Galaxy S8 to an S9, but it's not quite there yet, I think. But to that, you know, to that extent, I just want to talk, before we shift over to CES, just about the impact on the Apple of the Android world. And I'm not talking about Google here. I'm talking about Samsung. This is a company that was heralded as the big competitor, the company that was going to keep the iPhone at bay. And to some extent, that is true. But Apple or Samsung had a pretty weak 2018 by all accounts. The sales of the Galaxy S9, even though it was a talk year, was soft, and I think softer than Samsung would have liked to admit. They don't they don't disclose unit sales like Apple doesn't do anymore. But we know based on analysis that it was under 40 million for both models, which is much lower than the Galaxy S8. So where do you see Samsung in 2019? I mean, are there opportunities here with 5G, with the foldable phone, to get the company back into the conversation? Or is the age of the one true Android vendor kind of gone?
It depends on the market. One thing that, you know, we've been talking about, all these Chinese vendors that are doing great, but the U.S. is still a very insulated market. And, you know, while, I mean, things are looking up for OnePlus with the deal with the carrier, and I think it's going to take time to see the same kind of diversity in the U.S. market that you see elsewhere. In a way, you know, we talk about Europe as if it was one market, but it isn't. And so it is much easier for vendors to go into one country in Europe and kind of build from there than it is coming into the US market. And so, you know, depending where you are, things are going to look a little bit different. But there's no question that, you know, competition is way stronger in the Android ecosystem today than it has been over the past, I would say, 5 years. And Samsung is the one that needs to watch his back more than anybody else. I do think that what they have started to do in the mid-tier is going to help them somewhat. So focusing on delivering more innovation in the mid-tier, because that's, from a price point perspective, that's where they're getting hurt by the Chinese vendors that are coming in at similar, you know, prices for features that are always superior to what Samsung used to put in mid-tier phones. So that is one step. As far as 5G and foldable, I think it might give them leadership from a technology perspective, but from a volume perspective, I don't see that making a huge difference. It will help ASP, so the price, if the volumes are decent, but you are still talking about really early tech adopters. You know, the foldable phone is not going to be cheap. 5G is not going to be deployed widely from a network perspective in 2019. So again, you know, you are talking about niche products for this year that will give them the idea of we are still the leader when it comes to tech. From a price perspective, it might bump up their average ASP. But from a volume, you're waiting for 2020, 2021, so that the price of those devices come down because of increased volume. And so it becomes more of a, not just early adopter, but, you know, early mainstream and then mainstream in 2021. So it's tough. And I think what Samsung has been trying to do which I think shorter term should bring them more value, is creating stickiness across devices. I don't think they're moving as fast as they should when it comes to that. And so the idea that like Apple, I buy a Samsung PC or a Samsung wearable, and I have a phone and I have a TV, and all of that makes it for a more sticky environment for me as a user. And so I stay more loyal, and I get more from a return on investment in that ecosystem. I have not seen that played out for them yet. But that, especially for the higher end user, is their, I mean, my view, is the long term that bet that they have to make, especially with, the recent acquisition that they made of Harman and how smart things come into play when you're talking about connected home.
Yeah, and I want to use this opportunity to transition over to our conversation about CES. As we're recording this, it's Friday, January 4th. I leave for Vegas tomorrow morning. I'm sure you, when do you leave?
Sunday.
Okay. So you get a couple of days respite.
Get a day.
and you're closer. You're on the West Coast, so
that's
you don't
right.
have to travel quite as far. But I'm going into CES. This is, I think, my sixth CES. When I started, my first year was back in 2012. It was much more gadget or smartphone focused. In particular, the mobile ecosystem was much more opaque. You would get phone announcements. People would be excited about them. And then on the periphery, you'd get things like, innovations happening in AI, in robotics, in drones, in televisions. Obviously, CES has always been about televisions. But, this year, I'm actually not sure what the story is. And I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. I'm just, from an Android perspective, I don't have a lot to look forward to. And yet that does not bother me because, as we've been talking about, the smartphone ecosystem is slowing, it's maturing, it's saturating. And there's so much other exciting stuff happening in what was the margins and is now becoming much more central. So talk us through your biggest expectations for CES 2019.
It's been a few years, to be honest with you, that I walk into this store with not a lot of expectation. Maybe because it's hard to make sense of what the story is. And I'm not a big automotive fan. I like cars, but I don't. That's not like a core of my coverage. And there's a lot going on there. Cars everywhere, and they have different, from autonomous driving to actually what happens within the car, and so how the car is changing from just being able to transport you somewhere to actually, not just physically, but mentally, as the car drives itself, that becomes more an extension to your sitting room, and the seat becomes your sofa. So there's a lot happening there inside the car that is interesting. But for me, this year is going to be, yes, more cars, is going to be AI and machine learning, and so see where that brings some of the experiences that we have both inside and outside the home. Connected home is smart everything. We'll see, what else is able to talk to me and do things for me before I ask. Last year was a shower. I heard that this year toilets are going to be super smart. That there was somebody pitching a cat litter tray that is IoT enabled. So there's all of that, everything smart. And then gaming, I think, I agree with you. We're not going to see a lot around mobile, but I think PC will see quite a bit, and especially around gaming PC. Gaming on PC is sexy again, which is interesting and is benefiting the vendors from an ASP perspective. So, they see ASP growth there, if even if sales remain flat. that, and then AR, VR will be there. I don't know if it's going to be particularly exciting. But generally, I think the problem with CES, you were saying, you know, back when you started, was around when I started as well, because when I was in Europe, I only came here a couple of times. So I'm probably number 9 this year, whereas I lost track of how many Mobile World Congress I've done.
Yeah.
But back then, you were going to CES and you knew that most of what you were seeing was coming to market, and was coming to market within the year. Now it's no longer like that. You know, the technology cycles are longer for some of the stuff that we are looking at, not just because of technology, but because of regulations and other things that need to happen around the product that the vendors are talking to us about. And so it's, you know, both exciting for the long term, but a bit disappointing that you come home and it's like, okay, I'm going to have to wait 7 years before I see this coming to, you know, a store near me. And I think that's just the reality of it.
So given the size of CES and sort of this diffuse nature of all the announcements, you know, what I'm interested in it is, you know, we've been waiting for the I think the cohesion of the voice platforms to set in over the last few years. I think since 2014 and more so in 2015 when Amazon with its, I'm not going to say the hot word, but when Amazon increased its presence, right? You know, I think it's important to know that, like, last year, despite the rain and being just completely drenched out, Google had a massive, massive presence at CES with Google Assistant, made a bunch of big announcements. It was the introduction of the smart display ecosystem that took months to hit the market. But I think that was my biggest and most important announcement that happened last year. You know, we're at a point now where even the voice ecosystems are maturing. Amazon's and Google's, and to some extent Apple's, is, you know, it kind of, everything works with everything. So where do you think that is moving to? And can we expect a bit more of a wider pitch to the average person about why you now want to invest in the smart home?
I hope that instead of the wider pitch, it becomes a better pitch, because you're right. Yeah, almost everything works with everything, but not always and not necessarily easily, right? And so there's, I think, still a lot of work that needs to be done to finesse the experience to the point where your mass market consumer feels okay to engage with this assistance for more than setting a timer and asking for the weather. Because if this is all we're doing, it's not worth the investment, right? These companies, you know, Amazon and Google in particular, but Apple too. It's just that with Apple, we haven't seen the same kind of return yet. The investment they're making is because they want people to engage with the assistant for a lot of the things that they do throughout the day, so that becomes another lock-in from an ecosystem perspective. So that, you know, I do engage with Alexa a lot at home, and I want her to be with me everywhere I go. And that's the one I trust. And that becomes, you know, the reason why I'm not going to go anywhere else.
Well, I was just going to say, what's interesting is that despite, you know, Amazon's lack of a phone presence, and I think, you know, even though it's been fairly good about trying to partner with OEMs and integrating Alexa into various apps, it has not obviously reached the point where it's as ubiquitous as Google Assistant on the phone.
That's right.
And yet it's everywhere else. It's everywhere. It's in smart thermostats. It's in Bluetooth speakers. It's everywhere else that you can want. It's in a singing fish if you want it. It's in a clock. It's in a microwave. You know, it's at this point where you can expect ambient availability of these smart voice assistants, even if you don't explicitly buy a Google Home or an Amazon Echo. And, you know, to me, that I think, you know, putting security and privacy aside, if you trust these companies to take care of your data, which many don't, but if you do trust them to do so, that ambient ubiquity, I think, is what they are striving for.
Absolutely. And the more you use it, the smarter in reality, or at least on paper, the assistant becomes. And so, you know, it's that idea of, it's a bit of a domino effect, right? You start to use some things, you think that you get what you want, you're going to use more, and you're pushing and pushing and pushing to do more. And then you're getting to a point where when you're outside and you can't use Alexa and you're going to start using, you know, Google Assistant, will Google Assistant be as smart because she doesn't know you as well as Alexa does, because in the home you use Alexa all the time? And I think this is the great advantage that Google Assistant has, right? That is everywhere, both in your pocket and within the home. And the same can be said about Siri. How, you know, Amazon is going to solve that problem, we don't know. There were more rumors about a phone in 2019. I remain a little bit skeptical just because of all the things that we've been discussing up until now about the smartphone market. But, you know, the idea of the assistant, it is that through use, it becomes smarter and it does things for you based on the knowledge of you that you're not even having to ask. And that's and we're so far away from that in the biggest scheme of things, right? That I think that that's where I would like to see more focus, including a reassurance of, you know, where the data is, how it's stored, and security in general, which I think we're just a step away from, you know, somebody having a disaster within the home and blaming it on, you know, somebody said, Alexa, open the door, and the door opened and I got burgled, you know, kind of thing. So,
I mean, there are so many ethics questions there too. I remember a story about how one jurisdiction was able to subpoena records from Amazon Alexa to corroborate I believe it was an incidence of domestic abuse or assault.
Yeah.
And you know, that I think it makes sense, but it's also, you know, you have to understand that you're being monitored, and how many times, you know, I haven't had that many false starts, I guess, with the actual Amazon Echo and Google Home products. They're pretty good. They have very sensitive and very intelligent microphones. But with the companies like Sonos that integrate those voice assistants into their existing products, I have much more problems with those false starts. And I wonder, you know, Amazon in particular is going whole hog into just giving every OEM, every accessory maker access to the Alexa SDK and any APIs that go along with it. You know, and I wonder, you know, with LG, for instance, announcing earlier this week that it was integrating now Alexa into its 2019 OLED TVs, in addition to Google Home, Google Assistant, rather. You know, how confusing is this to the average user that just wants to pick one and settle down?
Yeah, I hope they're going to do it so that you can actually choose at the beginning, and so the other one, you know, doesn't even come to life, because that's, you know, the details of how the whole experience is going to work is what, from a user perspective, creates confusion, right? If I ask a question, who's going to answer me? I don't know. And there are companies that are in the hardware business that are thinking, well, you know what, I'm not going to just zero in on one assistant. I'm going to place my bets on everybody. And so my opportunity is wider, which is great. But then you need to give me an option as a user to just pick the one I want. But to your point about how confusing it is, I think it is confusing, and it's probably going to boil down to who do I trust more, and or who do I think gets it right the most? Because those are the two things, right? I might trust the company, but the experience I get is not what I'm expecting. And that seems where, you know, the Apple camp is resting. You know, they are Apple users. They trust Apple. Security is not a concern there. Monetization from me as a user is not a concern, but it's hit and miss when it comes to the experience. And so I'm not sure. And then you have, with Google, great response and great accuracy, support for multiple languages. I love that, given that I speak both Italian and English, and I can switch between the two without having to do anything other than an initial setup saying that I speak both languages. That is phenomenal. But what happens to my data? And then there's Amazon, where I know what happens to my data. I just get better recommendation when I go on Amazon.com. For me, the return of investment in that is okay. And it's great in the home, but then I'm not quite sure what am I going to do when I'm outside, because the app, frankly, on the phone, it's more like a control center than not really a good way to interact with Alexa. And I think, you know, we started to see Amazon trying to address that with bringing Alexa into your car. And so we'll see in 2009 what else is coming. So I think, you know, that's in my mind how the more educated consumer, and I don't mean it in a kind of a stuck-up way, but just, you know, people that read about technology and keep up with news are going to think about it. For the mass market, it's still like talking to technology, which is not necessarily something that comes easily unless you have a speaker where you have no other way to interact with this thing and you buy in a conscious way. But, you know, how many people talk to their thermostat? How natural is that? You know, we're still experimenting quite a bit with everything with a voice.
And then there's projects like Google Duplex that purport to make interacting with machines human-like, and the closer you get, we approach that uncanny valley experience. And then, you know, by 2025, when 5G is ubiquitous and the latency is non-existent, we'll have, I think, a much better idea of how these voice assistants and ecosystems in general are going to have long-term impacts on our lives, because they just will be, as I said, ambient and everywhere.
They disappear and they're there. And so that creepiness of, you forget that they're there, but then all of a sudden you realize, I think Siri is kind of cute when she does that, mm-hmm. And you go like, I wasn't talking to you. Why are you listening to me?
Oh, that's so creepy. I hate it when that happens.
But, you know, that's where we're going, exactly to your point, where, you know, when connectivity is not an issue anymore, when the pipe is big enough for all our, you know, 75 devices to be connected and not having hiccups in that experience, we're just going to forget. And I don't know if that's good or bad.
I think it'll depend on who you're talking to. And that's, you know, this year or last year even drove a wedge between those who want to embrace this ubiquity of data collection in favor of better recommendation and better convenience, and those who balked at the idea of overreach and too much data collection. So, you know, this will only, I think, get more stark. Just like, you know, politics is so divided, I think there will be an increasing politics of data and politics of big tech, and you know, that's a whole other podcast. But I think you see this playing out on a micro scale at shows like CES, where the benevolence of tech and the benevolence of the companies that innovate are unquestioned. You don't see keynote speakers criticizing companies like Google and Facebook at CES. You're meant to worship at the feet of these companies for improving our lives and for making them easier and better and everything cheaper and more ubiquitous. And it's only after the fact, when these products come out and you see them integrate into our lives, that you get an opportunity to really criticize and dig into why they are either good or bad for us.
And it's interesting to me because I agree with everything you said, and a lot of it goes down to the leaders in these companies that don't necessarily, and I'm not saying they're all evil and they just think about, you know, their own money, but I don't think that they're necessarily in touch with your, you know, normal consumer and a regular life to understand the implications of what they're bringing to market. And I think Facebook has been the best example this year where, you know, you feel that management is a bit out of touch with reality, to be honest. And I think that for a lot of the things that we are talking about, from AI to autonomous driving and all the rest of it, there needs to be so much more time spent in understanding not the technology, but human behavior and all the way that somebody can take something that is designed to be good and make it bad, because sadly, we're going to see a lot of it.
Yeah. So I think that is a good place to leave it, because I will see you,
but
it's a little intimidating, but you know, I will see you in a couple of days in Vegas. For me, it's a step in the warmer direction, because it's -2 here today in Celsius. You know, it's snow on the ground, so at least it'll be a bit warmer. I just want to thank you so much for joining me. It's been such a pleasure having you. If people want to find out where you write, where you are, where can they do that?
They can find me on Twitter at @Caro_Milanesi, MIAANESI. And I have a weekly column on techpinions.com.
Wonderful. Yeah, highly, highly recommend TechPinions. I read it religiously. This is the free stuff. I don't yet pay yet, but I'm leaning in that direction. I'm hoping my company can justify the expense, because it's wonderful, wonderful writing. All right, Carolina, thank you so much. Thank you for listening. If you're out there, send us some feedback, podcast@androidcentral.com. We love hearing from you. My name is Daniel Bader. We will be live from CES 2019 next week, so stick around. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you again very soon.